You listen to this podcast because you like books, or maybe because you like learning, or maybe you just like the sound of my voice lulling you to sleep. If it's the first two, Audible has you covered. Too busy to read? Driving and don't want to run into another dog? Audible is a huge library of audiobooks where people read to you like you're a kid again. And guess what? You can try it out for free. Just go to readlearnlivepodcast.com/audible to sign up for your free trial today.
One of the takeaways from the making of Les Bleus that I would encourage soccer officials, coaches, or parents in the United States to consider is how the French have created a somewhat different model that is not pay to play. You know, part of the French apparatus for their sports programs is if you're part of the official club with your license, and if you're in the youth academies or the sports sections at local schools, your equipment is provided for.
Hello and welcome to Read, Learn, Live, the podcast about improving yourself through literature. I'm your acclaimed host, John Monaster, and I'd like to welcome you to episode 25, The Dreaded Mid-20s. As always, if you have ideas for books you'd like to see featured, or of authors you want to put me in touch with, you can reach me at jon@readlearnlivepodcast.com. Today, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak with author Lindsay Krasnov about her book, The Making of Les Bleus. Dr. Lindsay Sarah Krasnov is an international sports writer, historian, and consultant, working at the intersection of sports, international affairs, and global communications. The author of The Making of Les Bleus, Sport in France, 1958 to 2010, her work on how identity, immigration, race, gender, and diplomacy play into our world today appears in CNN International, Sports Illustrated, Roads and Kingdoms, The New Yorker, The New York Times, Revue France Forum, Vice Sport, and more. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Read, Learn, Live podcast. My name is John Monaster, and I am your host. I am here in beautiful New York City with Lindsay Krasnov, and we're here to talk about her book, The Making of Les Bleus. Lindsay, say hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being on. I'm so excited to chat. This book was really interesting and opened my eyes to an entire subject I actually knew nothing about. And I love to learn, so this was great. So I always ask everyone to start off by just summarizing the book. Tell us what this book is all about.
This book is at its crux, history and the evolution of French sports policy under the Fifth Republic. So since 1958 through 2010, that's perhaps the first layer, but it looks at it more through the prism of how France developed several pronged youth development systems. So youth training in pretty much every single sport in a very different way than what we know of here in the United States, and providing the larger context of sport in France.
Great. Yeah, and that's there are so many questions that I have from that. This book was super detailed and really interesting. But just to start off with, I always like to get into the writing process a little bit because that I think is important and fascinates me. So I'll just start off with, why did you decide now was the right time to write a book about that particular subject?
You know, that's a terrific question. When I first began my initial research for what would become this book, it was the early 2000s, so just after France won the World Cup in football, soccer, and the European Championship in 1998 and 2000. And at the time, I was looking more at the present, so how France created a generation of players who were sustaining the elite soccer programs at a very high level, internationally speaking. And as my research progressed, the question became, well, if this is how the system works today, how did it get to be that way? Most people, when you think of France, you think food, you think fashion, you don't really think football or sport more broadly. Of course, there are the Olympics of Frenchman Pierre de Coubertin, often associated as being the modern founding father of the Olympic movement. But many people just disassociate the French from sport. So it was a good time to be looking at this topic. And as my research continued and as I began writing the book, it occurred over an interesting period in very modern French history. A lot of youth uprising, a lot of discourse about who is French, what it means to be French, through these lenses of race, identity, and immigration. And for better or for worse, the national soccer team was caught in the crosshairs, which is, or at the time, was something rather new for France. There's typically not been the same sort of intersection of sports and politics in France that we might be a little bit more used to here in the United States. You know, for example, there's been this tradition of athlete activists here in the U.S., going back to Bill Russell, Muhammad Ali, even Jackie Robinson. France has lacked that same sort of history until the late 1990s with the rise of the far right-wing National Front. By the time you get to the 2000s, the intersection of sport and politics is very hard to miss. So it was a very good time to be writing and working on this topic. While the book focuses predominantly on soccer, it also addresses the nation's second most popularly played sport, which is basketball, even though basketball is not the most widely or second widely consumed sport.
Hmm. So you did a ton of research, and this book is very exhaustive in terms of the depth that goes into all the information that you gathered. It's really a lot of new content. So, one of the things I was curious about was what was your writing process like? How did you assemble this book?
Very painstaking.
Yeah.
It involved a series of research trips over a series of years back to France to work in the government archives, which function very differently than those that we have here in the United States, mostly because for this particular topic, France has a Ministry of Youth and Sport. So there is an entire cache of documents that I was able to go through and read through and better understand how sports policy was made. I also had to spend a lot of time working in the press archives, because naturally for sports, that's another good primary source to really start to piece together the information. I also did speak with several people who were growing up playing in the youth programs or organizing the youth programs or trying to form the youth sports policy at the time that I was examining. First-hand interviews, oral histories, we'll call in the history genre, helped to provide a lot of missing gaps because a lot of this information is just things that was not covered in the government archives, not talked about in the press, still had not made its way to be published in memoirs or retrospective articles. So it was through compiling a variety of sources and then mashing it all together.
Yeah. So you did a lot. Was there anything that you felt was particularly difficult within all that to get done?
That's a really good question. I think one of the things that was difficult at the time, and I've since learned, was trying to be connected with the key stakeholders who were in the system. Mm-hmm. It was one thing to speak with people who were growing up or creating policy at the time. But one of the things that this book lacks, which I've subsequently come across in my onwards work, is having a much larger context of the greater social cultural issues that were involved, such as certain stereotypes or prejudices and just towards certain sports, not just people, but certain sports, and kind of this intellectual cultural backdrop that exists much more forthrightly in France than it does here in the United States concerning the sports realm, more or less.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that really interested me was that you did a lot of interviews. You did a lot of oral history work mm-hmm. for this. How did you get in touch with these people? How did that process go? How's your friend? You know, were you mm-hmm. getting translated? How did that work as far as the book?
Great question. A lot of those oral histories began as my master's project. when I was working in journalism and French studies. So at the time, they were very much slanted from a journalistic viewpoint and really captured kind of the crux of the era at that point in time. And those sources continued to provide feedback and additional information over the years that I was working on the topic. For a lot of them, though, I would have to say that I was lucky that people were very generous with their time. That when I first began my early phases of research, the internet was around, but not as prevalent as it is today. I remember there were many people who just did not have an email contact. And so I wrote a lot of regular hard copy snail mail letters and would wait to receive written responses back. Of course, whenever I'd be in France, things moved much more fluidly. People were great, would pick up the phone and say, I have this American researcher here working on XYZ topic. It sounds like this is something that you can also speak to. Do you have some time while she is here to speak to her? And so I was very lucky that people were so generous with their time that they were also thinking outside of the box in terms of they knew much more intimately who I should be speaking with. And, you know, one great example, I think, was the Corps of Doctors who I spoke with, who were great in providing a very different sort of context for sports policy and youth development programs. And, you know, they would say, oh, but you should also speak to so-and-so because they're a specialist in XYZ. And it was through those sorts of outside-the-box contacts and conversations that I was able to eventually make my way to some of the key people in the story.
That's interesting. So you weren't necessarily able to go straight to the major players. You kind of had to work your way around and get referrals and kind of end up at the...
Right, because at the time, you know, certainly I submitted requests to the big major players, but I'm not sure exactly where they landed on the map, but it was, you know, through a series of networked chains that I did get to them. And, you know, that's the important part. But also equally important is that I got all of these really great stories from other points of view, other sources that helped to round out a lot of that material.
Yeah. So maybe a great question for just to start off our discussion about the content of the book itself is, you know, who are the Les Bleus? What does that phrase mean?
Les Bleus refers, it's the name of the national team, not just the national football team, pretty much any of the national sports team. The men's sports team are Les Bleus. For basketball, it's Les Bleus. For handball, well, they have a slightly different nickname. For the women, it's the feminine version of Les Bleus. And it really refers to part of the French tricolor flag, the bleu, blanc, rouge.
There you go. So, you know, you mentioned at the very beginning that the book was about the connection between sport and policy and politics. So why do you feel like that the two became so interconnected? Why did sport become an affair of state?
Most things under the Fifth Republic became an affair of state.
Yeah.
That's a great question. It dates back to 1960, the Rome Olympics, which is kind of considered D-Day for the French sports world. Rome was one of the first major watersheds in modern Olympics because it was the first Olympiad to be fully televised in color, in real time, transmitted live to a variety of places around the world. And so when you think of just the power of moving images in real time and what it says to have your nation's athletes winning gold or just barely beating out the next person, that certainly had a very potent impact. And the French were all excited for it. They anticipated doing quite well in a number of different fields. But yet, once the Olympics started, they failed to follow through on that. And in the end, they only medaled, five medals total, ranging between some bronze and silvers in sports such as, I think it's equestrian and either rowing or fencing, I forget offhand. But it put them 25th in the overall medal table. And this was when you start to have the Cold War infused in the international sports world. Mm-hmm. To be at the top of that medal table indicated that you had a certain degree of power, influence. This is kind of the soft power that we talk about.
Yeah.
When we talk about international relations. And therefore, you know, you had the victory of ideas, as it were. And for France in 1960, which had just decolonized its former holdings in Southeast Asia with the end of the Indochina War in 1954, for France that was in the middle of the Algerian War, for France that was pretty much 1960, that was a big year for decolonization throughout Francophone Africa. It was a conglomeration of different things.
Hmm.
Then to have this lackluster result on a major international stage, just when all the hard power events around the world seem to indicate that you're no longer a great power, it was a huge blow to morale, especially for de Gaulle, who ordered a state study of what went wrong.
Hmm. Yeah, and so that's really interesting to think about because when I was reading it, that's not something that I would have considered. You know, I wouldn't have thought that that's how that happened. You know, that I guess I wouldn't have imagined that sports might play such an outsized role in politics like that. So that's.
Well, they increasingly did for medium and smaller sized countries in the Cold War, because sport was an area where they could compete, or at least within certain sports, whereas mm-hmm. it was very difficult for France, say, with a population of 60, 65 million people, to be competitive in a variety of different ways with the Soviet Union or the United States, which had multiple times that sort of population, resources, you name it.
Yeah. So you mentioned, this idea of soft power. And at the beginning, when you were describing the book, you mentioned youth programs. So, you know, one of the things that the study that de Gaulle commissioned, you know, talked about was this idea of youth programs. And so, you know, how were these youth programs then used that were created after that? How were they used to help with these, with the issue of sport? And then it seems like more broadly, they were also designed to help with other domestic issues and tensions that France was facing.
Exactly. Because 1960 was right in the middle of the youth crisis.
Mm-hmm.
France, like other countries in the West, the United States, Britain, Germany, even Japan, Italy, everyone had a influx of youth after mm-hmm. the Second World War, the baby boom.
Baby boom, yeah.
And it is known as le baby boom.
really?
So, that's, you know, great. And for France, it was felt especially potently because for over a century, the French birth rate had been on the decline, dating back to the Napoleonic Wars. And so now, for the first time, not only do you have more babies and adolescents and so forth, who then work their way, you know, into maturity and into the general population, but a country that's not really equipped to school them, to provide all the consumer services that are related to clothing them, reading to them, everything that goes along with that. So they helped to spur the 30 years of economic prosperity that was also ongoing for the 30 years after the Second World War. But as these baby boomers began to be teenagers, they began to be looking to outside influences culturally, such as particularly in the late 1950s to American culture, Coca-Cola, Elvis Presley, rock and roll, right, all that sort of stuff. But by the early 1960s, there starts to be a switch over in who the youth are looking to for their cultural cues. It's no longer the Americans only, but also the British, who increasingly become more influential throughout the 1960s. And that particular aspect is not quite new. When you look at the original evolution of modern sport in France in the mid to late 19th century, particularly with the team sports, a lot of the team sports that were brought into France were brought from Great Britain by the upper classes and the upper middle bourgeoisie who sought to emulate British bourgeois elite culture. So that part was not particularly new. But when you start to have a very large youth population looking to outside influences, looking to influences that are perhaps upsetting cultural norms that are not traditionally French, that starts to be concerning. When they start to advance through the school system and become older and older and getting interested in other ideologies or starting to protest some of the present social state of affairs, that becomes worrisome to authorities and authority figures. So you start to see the youth crisis coming into play by the 1960s, and sport was seized on by French officials and by French parents as a way to occupy your kids when they're not in school, albeit the school day was very long. It was better to have them playing some sort of sport than hanging out, doing drugs, listening to rock and roll, all that sort of thing. That being said, after school sport was not as popular or prevalent at the time in 1960s, 1970s France as we think of here in the United States. So that bears keeping in mind.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that the French tried to do when they were revitalizing or creating these new youth programs was that they wanted to sort of create a blend, right? They wanted to have sports, they wanted to have academics, and then they also brought in doctors. You know, they actually treated these kids like pretty seriously, as in like they had them medically supervised very carefully. So, I mean, talk maybe about the interplay between all those things and how that they achieved that balance.
Well, so it depended upon which of the youth systems one was operating in. At the elite youth intake system that was officially created in 1975, that is when you see full-on medical supervision consistently through and through. But if you were just part of the regular sports study sections that were created in the early 1970s and tried to solve this, how do we encourage greater athletic participation while still providing for ways for students to finish their schooling every year in order to get your sports license, which was necessary in order to participate in any sort of formalized sports activity. You had to have a doctor sign off that you were fit to play. And it's very similar to what we have here in the States in that aspect. Every season, you know, school season, if you were playing on a team, in order to be eligible to play, you have to have your doctor sign off.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, that's one of the later questions, but I am curious about that. Yeah. Talk more about the license. What does that actually mean? Was there anything beyond the doctor sign-off? I thought it was interesting that phrase, you needed to have a license to play competitive sports or even practice with a club.
Right. So one of the major differences between not just the French, but the larger European model, and it's also adopted in many other parts of the world and the United States model, is that to participate in any type of formalized competition, you need to have a sports license from your sports national federation. So, for example, say that I am a young soccer player or an old soccer player or a middle-aged soccer player. If I want to participate in my local club, I need to get a license every year or renew it every year with my national soccer federation. And on the side of the federation, that's really a way for them to keep track of who is playing in official capacities. It helps in terms of resources for financial issues, in terms of personnel resources as well, for coaches and that sort of counting metrics.
Yeah. Makes sense. So you briefly touched on some of the different programs. So yeah, maybe talk about what were the major initiatives France launched to really overcome that crisis that they faced after Rome?
Well, initially in the 1960s, there were a series of four-year sports plans that were launched, really to try to encourage more youths to play, to construct more sports terrains or sporting grounds, so that those who wanted to play had a place to play in. They tried to make sports more accessible, and they also, for those who were trying to practice at the elite level, elite meaning those who represented France at major international competitions, tried to provide some sort of monetary support for them so that, you know, you have a way for your Olympic high jumper to put in their best efforts preparing for competition on your behalf while making sure that they are no longer working full-time jobs and only training on the side, which was one of the problems that the post-1960 study found, that our elite athletes, they have no time to train as fully as they should because they're all working full-time jobs.
Yeah.
Amongst other things.
They need to make money.
Right, yeah. Right. So state support for elite athletes, that was something that was also starting to come into play. And these plans continued and were renewed throughout the 1960s, but they still didn't have any hard concrete results. Hmm. Aside from swimming, track and field, and skiing, which the French excelled at throughout the 1960s and into the 1970s, a lot of the other sports disciplines, they were just not showing up in the medal tables. They're not competitive. When you look at the national basketball team, the men's team, after Rome, they failed to qualify for another Olympiad until 1984. So that just gives you, and this was a sport that the French traditionally excelled at.
Yeah.
So it just illustrates that it was endemic, mostly because a lot of youths were interested in doing other things rather than playing sports. In 1975, France enacted its first major national sports legislation called the Mazaud Law, after Pierre Mazaud, then Minister of Youth and Sport. And this law created a variety of different things. First, and this was particularly interesting, I thought, it inscribed sport as part of the national French culture, which you had never really had before. And this goes back to earlier in our conversation that even the French didn't necessarily associate themselves on a national brand level as sporting.
Yeah.
So it began to, it legislated sport as part of the national sports, national culture, national identity for the first time ever. It also created the elite school, sports school, INSEP, the National Institute of Sport, and I think today it's Excellence and Physical Performance, something like that, INSEP, located just outside of Paris. And this was where all of the elite level athletes for most sports, aside from at the time soccer, would spend their training. This was also where the elite youths, the aspiring, you know, top tier Olympians of the future, would also do their training.
Hmm. So all this stuff was going on in the 60s, an effort to really get the French youth into sports, get them excited. And then May 1968 happened. So talk a little bit about May 1968.
The events of May 1968 started as a student uprising at the university out in Nanterre and spread very quickly into the heart of Paris, to the Sorbonne and to other academic campuses, not just in Paris, but also throughout France. What began as a student protest against a wide variety of grievances against the state, against what they felt was a very outdated social structure, inability of the authorities to accommodate their larger numbers and schooling requirements and so forth, quickly spread to the labor sector. And workers, regular workers, joined in the strike. Even the media, the press, joined in the strike. And most of the nation's footballers joined in the strike. All going on strike, looking for better working conditions, kind of a breakdown of older mores.
Hmm. So what did this do to the youth sports movement? How did this affect everything?
It reinvigorated government officials' desire to create better functioning sports structures, again, as a way to not just to keep youths occupied, and that's not seen as necessarily to keep them diverted. It's more to keep them occupied in a constructive manner. There are lots of studies that cited the intrinsic positive aspects of going through sports programs, learning meritocracy, learning democracy and citizenship as it applies on the field. These playing by the rules, listening to the authority on the field, that's listening to the referee. But so it was felt that these were traits that were good to reinforce in any democratic society.
Yeah, fair enough. So we touched on this a little bit earlier, but there, when you mentioned in Rome in 1960 was the first Olympics that was broadcast in color, live, all over the world. And, you know, as sport went on, that was now what was happening. So, and I found that really interesting that's something that really throughout the book, I think the idea of, you know, print media, broadcast media, people are really affected by that. And especially the ability to, you know, watch a football match and see their favorite player close up or you know, and all that. So I guess one of the questions I had at a high level, how do you think that the print or broadcast media helped to merge athletics with France's image overall? What did they do that really brought those two together?
Well, increased mediatization of the sports world certainly helped there. And there's always a push and pull between broadcast media and various different sports within France, even to this day. Soccer is king. It's the number one sport. It's the most consumed. It's the most commodified. And that's the one that you readily find on television screens across France today, 20 years ago, 40 years ago, because of the money involved in TV broadcast rights. You know, that made it easier to broadcast those sorts of things. Whereas other sports that don't have the same sort of commercial appeal really suffer with the inability to have their major competitions broadcast on television. Especially, it's very important to have some of your major competitions be broadcast en clair on regular free television networks, so not on paid closed networks, so that people can see your athletes, can see your results and have access to that. Without access, you can't really build a following. You can't build an image. You can't build anything. And crucially, without access, you cannot build future young athletes in your sport.
Mm-hmm. Key. And you said something that was very interesting to me. You said, I think you said something to the effect of, you know, some sports are maybe more interesting to watch or more easily televisable. And I think that's generally true, but I'm really curious about that now. I mean, what makes a sport more interesting to watch or not? You know, like, why is it that, you know, something like, I don't want to pick on a sport too badly, but I don't know. You know, rowing isn't as popular as basketball to watch. You know, like, why is it that everybody will watch a basketball or a baseball or a football game, but not one of the other 1,000 sports that are out there?
Good question on the rowing. Perhaps that's a very good question. To just give an example, it's still difficult to be able to watch a basketball game in France on a free channel.
Oh, really?
Yes. Mm. Yes. If you want to watch NBA games, which are by far more numerous, you have to have a paid cable subscription to one of the special channels. To watch the top division French league, it's not on regular network television. So
it's still difficult to find. You know, you still have to make an effort.
Exactly. But football and rugby are the two that are most commercialized and the easiest to watch.
Yeah. So kind of just moving on closer to the present here. You wrote that the 70s, in which we've talked about a bit, but you really said that they were a fundamental shift in French's support, participation, and interaction with sport. How did this happen? And what is the force de frappe? Am I saying that right?
Force de frappe. The force de frappe is very different from the sports world. The force de frappe refers to the nuclear power. So this was France's big, atomic bomb, nuclear power project begun by De Gaulle in the 1960s and realized, I think, in 66?
I just remember a chapter title with that name. I think that's why I threw that in there.
Yes, and so the idea was very much that they hoped to produce a very similar sort of force de frappe, atomic power. But actually, this does play into the sports world a little bit because, returning to the topic of basketball, and not just because I'm working on that right now, but it is discussed in the book, basketball, which had traditionally been thought of very highly in France, for which the French national team did very well in the mid-century. They won the silver medal at the London 1948 Games. They won bronze in a variety of major international competitions in the 1950s. But again, after 1960, we're just unable to show up in strong force and pull it through in major international competitions until much later in time. You start to see a series of studies going on within the government, within the sports ministry, but also within the basketball federation. Why, you know, what are we lacking? What do we need? There's the inability to keep youths interested in our sport for a variety of different reasons, but also we lack tall players who are the atomic armaments of our age. Mm-hmm. So the force de frappe in the book really kind of refers to this, not the actual hardcore nuclear power, but more metaphorically about the sports power that was sought after. And that relates very much to the implementation of the Mazaud Law in 1975, as we mentioned. This was the first time that the state very solidly, very fully was behind sport as a national endeavor, as a national part of the culture, providing the structures, the finances, the expertise for it. There was a little of this during the Vichy regime, where there was this national physical culture phenomenon to try to create stronger French men and women for the nation. But 1975, this is very different. This is very much to produce elite athletes for the state.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that was discussed throughout the book and is, I think, a problem probably in every country when it comes to sport is immigration and racism towards immigrants. So you talked about this and tackled it. So maybe discuss a bit about French immigrants and the racism they faced and maybe currently face and how sports then interacted with that in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, France has always been a country of immigration, even dating back to the 18th century. So it has this long culture of assimilation. This was enshrined in the very first phase of the French Revolution. Even if you are not born French, you can become French, right? So France, very much like the United States, has at the core of its essence as a modern republic, this notion that you can become a citizen, citizenship of the soil, they call it, rather than, for example, Germany, which is still citizenship of the blood, right? In Germany, you have to be born German. That's changed a little bit more recently. But France, very much like the United States, you can become French. As long as you assimilate to French culture outwardly. So if you speak French, if you have the same actions, mannerisms, activities as the national body, you are French in the eyes of the state, and supposedly in the eyes of society, and that is that. Mm-hmm. As we know, that is not necessarily always reality, but that is the ideal. And assimilation is not a perfect system either. There are a variety of problems with it, but it has enabled generations after generations of immigrants to assimilate into the French social fabric, into French public life for several centuries. Where that intersects with sport is that by the time you have the rise of modern sports in the late 19th, early 20th century, you have a new way for immigrants to more easily become part of a local community, to become part of a local society through playing sports, because everyone's equal on the sports field. As long as you have relatively the same aptitudes, right? It doesn't matter who you come from, what you look like. This ideal of meritocracy, democracy, and proving yourself on the field. And it's particularly after the First World War. So starting in the 1920s, when a good swath of northern France is devastated because of the war, France has to look to other countries to import workers to help rebuild France. And French infrastructure, particularly the mining industries and the textile industries in the north. And you see a large influx of Poles come into France in the 1920s, 1930s, along with a lot of Russians fleeing the Russian Revolution. In the 1930s, you have Spaniards, you have Italians fleeing the regimes in Italy and Spain. And so forth. So this is something you always have. At the same time, you've also always had an influx of peoples from the French Empire. It was still an empire for a good part of the 20th century, coming to mainland France. But it's really the experience of the First World War that brings them to mainland France in large numbers for the first time. And while many of them go home after 1918, many of them don't. So you start to, have these other migration flows. I suppose those sorts of migration flows are not really considered immigration until you get to decolonization.
Mm-hmm.
But so you've always had this mixing of populations. The France, because of this ideal of assimilation, and you are French if you act certain ways or speak French and so forth, that is perhaps provided greater openness to including a variety of peoples under the larger sports umbrella, under this idea of citizenship, democracy, and meritocracy. And that's why you do see the first players of color on the national French teams starting in the 1930s. For the men's soccer team, Les Bleus, you have your first black French player in the 1930s. On the side of basketball in the 1950s. So kind of this longer tradition of a mélange of players. So sports has always traditionally provided that cover. That being said, it has been more within recent years. So when you have the stronger intersection of politics into sports, particularly football, soccer, that this becomes problematic on the field and outside of the field. We mentioned racism against, or claims of racism against players, and I'm not saying anything to deny that. There certainly is in certain quarters. You really start to see those sorts of accusations and heated discussions crop up in the late 1990s into the 2000s and ever since. If those sorts of complaints existed in large forms or structures beforehand, they were not recorded for posterity. They were not part of the larger sports conversation in the same way as they've become used to today.
Hmm. So you mentioned earlier that the French basketball team didn't qualify again for the Olympics, I think after the 1960 until 1984.
Mm-hmm.
So 1984 was kind of a banner year. There was a lot of, a lot of victories, a lot of good stuff. So, maybe talk about what happened in 1984, why that was such a big change, and what the liberalization of the sports system looked like after that.
Well, 1984 is big on a variety of different levels. For basketball, they go to the Olympics, they go to LA. And actually, one of the star French players, Hervé Dubuisson, stayed in the US after the Olympics, and he played for the New Jersey Nets in the NBA's Summer League, making him not just the first French player to play in an NBA shirt, but the first European-born and trained player to play in an NBA shirt. So big in basketball in that way. But even bigger on the soccer side, 1984, so you had the French national soccer team winning the European Championship, which is huge. It was the first time that they had ever done that. And, you know, soccer was still king at that time. So it was a huge boost to morale on that side. And the men's Olympic soccer team did fairly well at LA as well. So very much demonstrating that the new systems that had begun to be implemented in the 1970s were paying off, because the men who were winning for French football in the early 1980s, these were men who had been trained in the early versions of the soccer youth academies. Michel Platini, Alain Giresse, all of that entire generation. They were the very first part of that wave to go through the French system. Mm-hmm. So it provided a lot of hope that had really not been around for a while. While the men's soccer team did very well at the 1982 World Cup, it had been a while.
Yeah.
It had been a while. And so it was a very feel-good sort of summer. This also coincided with the change in government in France. And the new sports minister, she was very much influenced by not just what she saw while in the United States for the Olympics, but also, I believe, her father-in-law was American. And so what she had picked up through that side of the family and learning more about the U.S. systems, because the initial French youth systems developed at INSEP and implemented in 1975 were originally inspired by those from East Germany. Mm. They weren't complete totalitarian systems. There was still a lot of leeway in there, but it was state-sponsored youth sports training alongside school. Mm-hmm. And so when Edwige Avice came in 1984, she very much sought to liberalize the system to open it up to some degree of private financing as well. And that started to encourage more competition and greater investment. Mm.
One of the other things, the problems or issues that you talked about that really occurred in multiple eras was the idea of doping. So maybe talk a bit about doping and the problems France experienced with it during the period you covered in the book, and sort of what their solutions were and the extent to which they were successful.
Doping has always been a part of modern sport, whether you want it to be or not. And there is circumstantial proof that it's been a problem at all age levels of the elite circuits. So there were indications of the 1960s that there was issues with doping. I think that was in the 1960s you started to see the first high caliber deaths from doping on the Tour de France and others. And I believe it was in 1965 that France and Belgium implemented the first anti-doping laws around making doping a criminal offense for elite competitors. There's a distinction to make, though. Passing law or legislation is one thing. Enforcing it is another. Mm-hmm. And the statistics for enforcing it are just not as concrete and solid.
Really?
So, you know, France has very much been known and touts itself for having a very strong anti-doping program, particularly for its youths, continuous education about what certain kinds of products or certain sorts of doping regimes can do, the dangers of it. And, you know, that is the claim with pretty much everyone up and down the board who I've spoken to. And the reasoning that I keep hearing over and over is that, well, in our sport, it's very different. You don't have strength in the same way. Or there's various different reasonings to it. But it's hard to believe that it's not there at the professional level in some sports, maybe not all, or at the elite level in some sports, maybe not all. It's a very gray area, and it's just very difficult to say.
It's gray in the sense that it's hard to test for all banned substances, or what makes it difficult to say?
Well, it's hard to it's hard to test for substances because usually athletes and those who are helping them dope are a step ahead of the medical testing technology. So there's that issue. But then there's also the much larger issue that no one is really willing to go on record to talk about. Doping and whether it's an issue or why it's not an issue. So
it's like Fight Club, just don't talk about it.
Right. So you have that other part of it. So it's very difficult to make a fully accurate assessment.
Interesting.
I'm not saying that doping is a big problem in the elite French sports system, but it would be very hard to believe that it doesn't exist at all.
Right. I mean, it sounds like more of what you're saying is it's just hard to know.
It's hard to know with any certainty.
Yeah. Okay. So moving along, let's inch closer towards the present day. So you talked a bit about this October 2001 France and Algeria game.
So that was shortly after the events of September 11th in the United States. And tensions were already high to begin with. Especially at major events with large crowds. But within the France-Algeria context, this is one of the first major confrontations between the two sides on French soil, pretty much since independence, 1962. And France had a very, well, they have a very mixed record with Algeria, to put it very lightly. And it's, you know, think 1962, it's not really that long ago. There are still a lot of raw emotions and a lot of youths who have, by the early 2000s, begun questioning their identity. Many had begun to feel rejected by the French mainstream. And that ties very much in with the rhetoric and the rise of the far right wing and their question of, well, who is French? You are not French. Of course, that's absurd. But so you started to have that and tensions ran amok. And before the game could even begin, a bunch of younger spectators rushed the field and rushed the players. The game was called off and there was a variety of fracas going on the field. And it caused a lot of soul searching, you know, was this actually another reiteration of the French-Algerian War, just in a different format? The flames were very much exacerbated by the Front National. But it was very much a kind of the first major clash, sports political clash of the two former colonizer colony.
And yeah, moving ahead a couple years from that, there were riots once again in October of 2005. What were those about and how did that affect youth sports?
The 2005 riots began over heavy police handedness, targeting youths of the ghettos, of the banlieue, and escalated very quickly as a larger social protest against not just the heavy-handed police forces in France, but also the sense of hopelessness that many young people felt about being discriminated against, being labeled and tabooed. And even though many of them were second or third generation French, they were still considered non-French by many. So that quickly escalated and sport was caught in the crosshairs because at the time, many members of the national team were of mixed race and mixed parentage, including many such as Karim Benzema, who do have this similar profile, Maghrebin background profile. And many of the players on the national team at the time came from some of these banlieue areas, maybe not the exact ones, but they were closely associated with it, even though they did not stand by the riots or anything of the sort. They got sucked up into the larger rabid discourse that began to tear the country apart even more. And sport is you started to see people denigrating the national team, the players on the national team, linking them with these same sorts of problems. And a lot of it also had to do with the fact that while football is the number one sport in France and the most played and consumed, it is still not really regarded very highly by the national opinion makers and elites. It was always seen as a sport of the working class, a sport of the immigrants. And so that also fed into a lot of the very racist discourse you did start to see crop up surrounding sport, racism, immigrants, and identity at that time.
Hmm. So the book officially finishes in 2010, but I don't know if you have any other thoughts about kind of where the book finishes and what you've seen up till now, you know, sort of the past decade. Where do things stand with French sports?
Well, I think the last part of my book looks at the issues in French sport, particularly at the level of the national soccer team in the 2000s, through this lens of race and identity, and really questions, is this the second sports crisis, where people are very much questioning the identity of players? What you've seen pretty much since 2013, when the national soccer team finally overcame setbacks in World Cup qualifiers and went on to qualify and play in the Brazil World Cup, the nation coming around the team again. It had been purged majoritively of a lot of the players who were on the team in 2010, who went on strike in South Africa, and that just inflamed a lot of the rabid, very denigrating discourse around sport and immigrants' identity and Frenchness in 2010. The team, by 2013, 2014, very conscious to make it known that they were French, that they are proud to be French, that they are there to win for the French. Even today, the slogan is "Fier d'être bleu," proud to be French. Or proud to be blue, but very similar thing. So they have done a multi-year rebranding effort, really fusing French identity, national team together, and really focusing on these questions of being good citizens. And so that is why, or one of the reasons why, you still do not have the national head coach, Didier Deschamps, selecting Karim Benzema, who had been caught in a sex tape scandal and a scandal of bribery against one of his fellow teammates, just not demonstrating the best citizenship, amongst other things. So it still feeds into it. Today, nationalism, identity, these are still constructs that are wrapped up with the national teams, but everyone is much more conscious of it in this age of not just internet, but social media, mm-hmm. which has started to really change things. And one of the things that you've begun to see is players speaking directly to the public, whether it's through their Twitter or Instagram accounts, or whether it's through new digital media platforms like Bros Stories, where one of the national team players, Blaise Matuidi, is able to go directly to his public and say specifically why he decided to do a trade or what he thinks about this, and eliminate the filter of the journalists who sometimes have been known to fan the flames of discourse because it sells papers.
Never you, though.
Oh, never me.
Very academic. So, just kind of wrapping up, we covered a lot. Is there anything in particular you wanted to let people know about that we haven't covered? Any ideas, lessons, overall takeaways that you thought might be important?
Well, you know, here's the thing, and it's come up with the recent failure of the U.S. men's soccer team to qualify for the Russia World Cup in 2018. There's been renewed focus on the soccer training systems here in the United States, who plays, why they play, and the pay-to-play system that dominates elite soccer for the most part in the United States. And so one of the takeaways from the making of Les Bleus that I would encourage soccer officials, coaches, or parents in the United States to consider is how the French have created a somewhat different model that is not pay to play. You know, part of the French apparatus for their sports programs is if you're part of the official club with your license, and if you're in the youth academies or the sports sections at local schools, your equipment is provided for. Mostly, not every last detail, but the very expensive stuff is usually provided for so that you have the ability to play. And if you are deemed good enough, if you show enough potential or good results, then you move up the ladder to different levels. And for example, in skiing, you know, once you get to the upper echelons of French skiing, you do get sponsorships or you get signed by the military who will help underwrite a lot of your equipment costs or so forth. So it's a very, I would encourage people to rethink the pay-to-play system. That being said, I don't think that the French system is necessarily the only one out there that should be examined. I think that some kind of fusion or blend of them might be a good answer for U.S. soccer. But it's a very interesting system with pluses and minuses, but perhaps something to look at.
Yeah. So a while back you mentioned basketball and that being something you're focused on now. So talk about what you're currently working on. What's up next?
What's up next? French cagers. How and why France became the number one supplier of NBA talent outside of North America. Ever. And also what it's like to be French in the NBA. And so it's a really interesting story that begins roughly around the same time in the 1950s, but talks a lot about the transatlantic influences that have helped to create today's French players in the NBA. So those who helped to pave the way to bring the style and the substance of the game, who provided opportunities for the French players to train. So the first generation of French players who saw in the NBA really making a huge impact, Tony Parker, Boris Diaw, Ronnie Turiaf, they were all part of the National Sports School at INSEP, which was created in 1975. So they're pure products of the French system. They have a lot of American influences in different ways. Tony Parker's father is American. And a few other influences both for Boris and Ronnie. But you see that there's this really interesting transatlantic cycle. And when you talk about French and basketball, it's not just mainland French, but there's a very large basketball program in the French Antilles, Guadeloupe and Martinique. And the Antilles are where Ronnie Turiaf is from. Other former French NBA players, Mike Gelabal, Rodrigue Bobois. So you have a lot of these really cool influences. And so what is it like to be French in the NBA today? Well, you'll have to stay
tuned.
You have to read,
yeah,
right.
Stay tuned. Okay, great. So I like to end with a thunder round, a couple quick questions to get to know you better, and then we'll call the day. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Okay, what's your favorite food and or drink?
You know, I was thinking about this one, and it's really hard to name a favorite food.
Yeah.
I'd have to say seafood more generally, so I just got back from a research trip to France, and one of my favorite things are the fruits de mer, the seafood, the crustaceans and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they have this snail, kind of like the escargot, but they're not cooked in the same way. And you get the snail and you get this very long utensil with a weird prong at the end. And you get to try to scoop your snail out of the shell and then eat it. It's cooked, but it's I think my love of it dates back to, I'm from New England, so I grew up on, you know, cracking your own lobster, playing with your food. It kind of comes as second nature.
Yeah, it gives you something to do. It feels like you're working.
A sense of accomplishment.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. Where's your favorite place you've ever been?
This is another one I was thinking about. I'd have to say favorite place I've ever been, Greece. Numerous places in Greece, but I found it really intriguing because it very much has this Western persona, but very strong Eastern influences as well. And I feel like I've, in the many times I've been there, I've only begun to scratch the surface a little bit. Mm. And so I find it very, very intriguing.
Yeah. And so if you could wave a magic wand and change any one thing, what would it be and why?
Any one thing in the book?
Any one thing, period. You can answer that question however you want. It's a very powerful magic wand.
That is, I need one of those magic wands. Mm-hmm. If I could change one thing, it would be for The Making of Les Bleus to have more of the intellectual and social context that I've since gained from working more in the field of journalism and international sport, to better understand the different influential factors that were not found in the archives, were not found in some of the interviews I did, and would have been really difficult to come at without doing extensive journalistic interviews.
Mm. All right, well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Lindsay Krasnoff, author of The Making of Les Bleus, excellent book. Give it a read. Lindsay, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, well, thanks everyone for listening to Read, Learn, Live. Have a great day. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Read, Learn, Live. If you liked it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. If you hated it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. And so it goes.